The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louise.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Dudes.
Dudes.
Yes. Dudes.
Yes. Dudes.
I'm a dude. He's a dude. She's
what is
a dude.
That from?
Because we're all dudes. Hey.
Oh, that's Good Burger, isn't it?
Correct.
Good Burger. Wow, nice pull.
Both of which I recently bought the Steelbook.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah, it's clean. I haven't watched it's that nice. Forever.
Good movie.
It is.
Abe
it is
Vigoda.
A good movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
I just always saw the sketch and all that, but I never saw the movie.
Yeah, it's worth it. Like, they did a good job because
right.
It's really funny.
I got pulled to go see it by somebody. I'm like, there's no fucking way I'm going to like this movie, but they just did a really
they
nice
They pull it
job.
Off. George Clinton is like a huge set piece in the whole
yes.
thing.
Yes.
Parliament Funk. But I will say this. I compare it a lot to Wayne's World in that it's the perfect film version of a sketch that was popular, right?
Right, yeah.
Because, like, Wayne's World as a sketch was top tier, in my opinion, in terms of the 90s, early mm-hmm. 90s SNL, right? That's, like, that's ultimate. And when they've brought it back, you know, now and then where they get, you know, Tom Hanks to come back on and do it or whatever,
yeah.
it always slays the house boots down. And I, And I think Good Burger does the same thing. It takes sort of the magic of the sketch and somehow expands it into a 90-minute perfect comedy. I love that movie so much.
And Good it's Burger. Just not easy. Like all those sketch movies were not a lot of them work. So totally. I'm with you.
We saw a movie last week together.
The three of us.
And it has to do with what this podcast has to do with.
Yeah.
It was called Theatre Camp.
Yes.
Theatre Camp.
Yes.
Written and directed by that foursome, Noah Galvin, Ben Platt, Molly something, and whatever something. The four people.
Yeah.
And it was a short film that they made together that then Mark Platt gave them the money to make a full film out
nice.
Of.
That must be nice, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Wouldn't it be nice if
we
had
were
parents
nepos.
Who could give us money to make our art? Wouldn't it So I enjoyed the movie about, well, CJ loved it, right?
Yes,
so
I was
in.
Laughing the entire fucking time.
CJ
and I even cried a little
in.
Bit at some point. So.
Oh, yeah.
Scott, what was your, like, percentage? CJ was, like, 100.
Yes.
Where were you at?
I was probably, like, 88.
Okay.
I was reluctant to see it, but everything else was sold out. So I was like, these two want to go see it. I'll go see it. Because I'm not a big Ben Platt fan. But to his credit, he does a good job playing an asswipe and who redeems himself a little bit. And
I think
so
he's
I was charmed
it,
by it.
But we'll talk about it.
Okay.
I think he's bad in it.
Oh.
I think he's laying it on too thick for what everybody else is doing.
Oh,
Everyone else feels more like they're in an episode of like The Office, and it's like more real and kind of, you know.
But he's the drama
more
teacher.
Natural. He feels like a caricature.
Okay.
And I don't feel that from really anybody else in the.
Right.
Oh, I felt that from a couple of. I mean, like, that's what I thought was kind of the fun of it, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was probably at like a 60%. I think it's like 60, but I'm not calling that a failing grade. I'm saying it's more like 60% of it I like really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And then like 40% of it I was like holding my breath. And like cringing really hard because it was a little close to home, especially as someone who teaches children. Right?
Who is literally doing theater camp
I'm
right
doing
now.
Theater camp right now. I came straight from theater camp to do this podcast right now, right? So it was hitting close to home to the point where like my palms were sweaty and
Aww.
I was like having trouble breathing, and I right. kept being like, "Ooh, okay, I gotta like relax," because it was a lot, and I have a lot of opinions about like how we treat children in theater and how we like the sexualizing and all that stuff, and they go for it, and
they go for it,
very
they call
real.
It out.
Yeah, and so I think maybe I need to see it again. I did give it 4 stars on Letterboxd, so out of 5. So, you know, I didn't give it a failing grade, but I think I enjoyed and, like, felt the heart of, like, 60% of it, and then 40% of it, I was like, I can never watch this movie again.
But it was good. I loved it. I've been telling everyone to go see it. I had so much fun.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who really, really loved it who aren't even theater people. So that's good. I was afraid that it would be consumed improperly and people would be like, these fucking stupid theater people.
Yeah, the fringe of movies, the Hollywood Fringe Festival of movies. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Gross. Well, and as always, I always have a great fucking time whether we're sitting on someone's couch watching it or going out and seeing a movie.
Is it spelled T-H-E-A-T-E-R? Or
E-R. E-R, they did it wrong.
So it's a camp about buildings.
That's right. That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
It's about
correct.
Theater buildings. Got it. Okay. No.
I will say that the kids really charmed the fuck out of me.
The kids
Those kids were amazing.
It. They're incredible.
Cishet bitch?
Cishet bitch? And I think the adult performer who does the greatest work is Noah Galvin as the stage manager who wants to be a performer.
Oh, yeah.
Because we all know those stage managers. And not to say that they're not performers, because sometimes they are, but we all know that person.
Yes.
You know, and I thought that was well done without being too true. Like, it's fulfilling a stereotype of the theater without the performance feeling like a caricature.
It's funny because I feel like I've known a fair amount of stage managers that hate actors.
Sure.
Yeah, of course. I would say the majority are those. But we also know the stage managers who are like, I'm a performer. I just stage manage on the side. And you're like, yeah, but I've only ever seen you stage manage.
Right.
Yes.
No offense. No offense. We love you guys. We love you.
Oh, that was me for a while. As soon as you let someone know that you can stage manage, all of a sudden...
Oh, yeah.
That's all you get asked to do.
Yeah, just don't say you do it.
Yeah.
And then, it makes it all better. Yeah, I stopped calling myself a producer because I was like, people just keep asking me to produce.
I've already gotten asked to produce something in the last week.
Say no. Say no.
No, I gotta do it.
Say no.
It's the one that I can't say no to, and I love
Say
them,
no.
So. No.
Say no.
Okay, will you produce my show?
Yeah, what about my show?
Yeah, see, good.
Because I love the both of you.
Okay, aww,
well.
And I know it's there's true. Things at producing that I'm pretty damn good at. So how can I not share my gifts?
That's right. The gift of theater. Speaking of.
Yeah.
Welcome.
What?
To Theater Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds. Made by 3 theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Birdshone.
I'm CJ Merriman.
I'm Scott Leggett.
Nice. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week we return to form, discussing the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at 3 of their plays.
That's correct.
Macro means big. Oh, we killed that.
We killed
and
that.
This, you're right. And this is
got
part.
Mad.
Yeah, I know. I got that. And this is part 1 of 3. Of our mini-series covering the works of Martin McDonagh.
Oh.
You have to say Martin McDonagh.
Yes, correct. And we're going to be taking a look at the 3 plays Beauty Queen of Lenon, Pillow Man, and Hangman?
Is that Hangman, the I think.
Hangman? Hangmen?
Men, yeah.
More than one?
Yes.
Cool, I haven't read it yet. Plural. So we'll get
I haven't either.
But I forgot... to come up with a name.
Oh, I was waiting with bated breath for that.
I'll throw some out just off the dome because I don't have them written down anything, okay? 3 podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Simple, direct, elegant.
The Banshees of Podcast Sheeran.
That's pretty good, too.
The Podcast Man, but that does like Pillow Man, but that feels a little too easy.
Yeah.
We like sweaty names on this podcast.
Yes. Sweaty.
The Beauty Pod of
I kind of liked Lenon? The podcast no, Queen work. Of Lenon.
The podcast Queen of Lenon. Lenon. I don't hate it. Yeah. I don't hate it. And, you know, we could go with, like, seven podcast paths. Seven psychopaths.
Sure.
It's not as nice.
I still like the three billboards.
I do too. Three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri. Because sometimes we split up pod and cast, and that's always funny, but I love the specificity of three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
His titles
starring
are kind
Francis
of
McDormand.
Straightforward. I don't know. His titles are like miniature sentences.
It's true.
Yeah.
The Lieutenant of Podcastmore? No, it doesn't work.
I think we're going for it.
I know it's not
podcasts.
A play, but it's
three
podcasts outside of the
thing.
So stupid. I am obsessed. Okay, so that's the name of the miniseries. Get into it. And
just wait until we get into the Euripides miniseries. Then we can have some fun with podcast.
That's right. And so technically this is CJ's pick week, mm-hmm. right? Beauty Queen
yep.
of Lenon.
Mm-hmm.
But
what?
There are two things we like to do before we actually get into talking about the play that we're going to talk about today. One is our context with Martin McDonagh.
Mm-hmm.
And two is Martin McDonagh's context, which Scott very beautifully gives to us. But I think we should start with our context with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scotch.
Yeah.
Scotch egg.
Bounds.
Tell me about your
Bailey's
relationship.
Bailey's Irish Cream.
Thank you. Yeah. I love it. Irish. Aw.
Yeah.
Irish playwright. Is this our second Irish playwright after Beckett? Do we have another one?
That sounds right.
Wilde's not Irish.
No.
Oh, Wilde is Irish. He's not? I thought he was Irish.
Oh, is he?
Well, he's
his statue
English.
Is in Dublin.
Right.
Oh,
but
maybe
was he
you're
born
right.
there?
His stat.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
he definitely went to Trinity College, I think, in Dublin. I believe he is Irish.
Mm. All right. Well.
Westland Road, Dublin.
Okay.
Born and
there
raised.
All
died
right.
there too. Okay.
Right.
Yep. Good to know. So this is part three of our Irish playwrights miniseries. Scott, what's your relationship?
Wow, not a lot. I mean, mostly the films. I had read Pillow Man. Years ago, shortly after it came out, a friend of mine had been to England and got a British copy of the script, British
cool.
published copy of it with David Tennant on the front. And so I'd read that and really liked it. And I've loved all of his movies. Banshees really blew me away.
Yeah,
last year
best
I was really
year.
It really affected me, and you can see that in this play, which is his first, well, not his first produced play that we're going to discuss today. That's pretty much it. Like, I haven't seen any on stage, so I'm excited to dig in, and it was really excited to dig into this play. Holy shit.
Yeah. Siege.
Yeah, I watched Banshees of Inisherin on because so many people were yelling in my face to watch it. I did not watch it at a good time in my life. I'm gonna go back and rewatch it. I might have seen one of his shows when I was in London the summer of 2005, but I need to go back and look at. I kept all my ticket stubs and stuff. I need to go back and look at it because I remember seeing a distinctly Irish play about prisoners.
Okay.
But I need to check that. But other than that, like, I'd always seen Beauty Queen of Lenon in, like, it was in my major traumatis book. And they produced Pillow Man at the St. Louis Rep in the Black Box season the year after I graduated. I just remember seeing the posters and stuff.
Right
on. But that's it. I very relatively little experience with him, which is usually my bag. So
Yeah.
What about you, Bales?
I read, I think it was Pillow Man it would have been Cripple of Inishman first in the script library at Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with it and then found out it was the first of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So, technically at the time it was a duology. but it was his second trilogy. So Cripple of Inishman was the same year, actually, of Beauty Queen. And it is followed by The Lieutenant of Inishmore, which I ended up reading. And then Banshees of Inisherin is the third in that trilogy.
Right. He had he said he abandoned the play.
Right. It was going to be a play.
It was going to be a play. He said he couldn't get it to work and it sucked and then
made it a movie.
Yeah.
And then there's a first trilogy that I've never even touched until now, which is Beauty Queen of Lenan, A Skull in Connemara, and The Lonesome West. Mm-hmm. So I have not read any of those until I read Beauty Queen for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love Beauty Queen. I'm really excited to read the other two in that trilogy at some point. But then Pillow Man is something that was kind of passed around in my... That Hogwarts
yeah,
and
Pillow Man was
I think
kind
it got
of,
a lot of buzz.
Yeah, it was. And part of it was that we were young and people were being like, this is fucked up. And you're like, ooh. You know, it's kind of like early Sarah Kane being introduced to me. Somebody was like, fucking blasted, dude. And I read it and I was like, yeah, you know. And then I came to realize the depth of those that work, right? And I think Pillow Man, same thing. I think at first I was just like, shock factor. And then I went, oh, shit, there's really something here. I don't know, The Handing in Spokane. I don't know, like, he has a bunch of other stuff,
yeah.
But I've seen in Bruges, Seven Psychopaths is phenomenal. Three Billboards, I am madly in love with, and, Banshee.
That's available for streaming too, right?
Absolutely.
Like, I kind of want to sit on and watch that one.
We should. We should watch it together. Anyway, yeah, that's my relationship. I've always loved him. I think he's great.
I just wanted to holler out too for anyone following along on this miniseries. Scribd has all three of the scripts that we're covering.
Yeah.
Read
along.
Yeah, it's been a delight thus far. I've gotten through Beauty Queen and Pillow Man. I just was like, I've had free time, so I was like, why don't I get ahead for the podcast?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So I want to know about the dude himself.
Mm-hmm.
Scotch Egg, help me out.
All right.
Whenever you're ready.
All right.
Scottpedia.
Martin Ferenin McDonough.
Hey.
Oh my.
Ferenin. Ferenin.
That's Irish as fuck.
Yeah, right. Was born, but hold that, because that's a little controversial.
He wasn't not actually born, let's be clear. He was grown out of a potato field in... No, go ahead.
He was born on 26 March 1970, if we're saying it like the Brits say it. He is a British / Irish playwright and filmmaker. He is known for his absurdist black humor, which often challenges the modern theater aesthetic. He was born in Camberwell, London, to Irish parents. His mother was originally from County Sligo. County's real big in Ireland.
Yes.
They're really into the counties. And then his dad was from Galway, which comes into play very quickly. And his parents moved back in 1992 to Ireland. But he and his brother, John Michael McDonough, who's also a writer-director, they stayed in London. That's right. Mm. Although he's known as one of the most acclaimed Irish playwrights alive today, McDonough is actually British. He technically holds both a British and Irish citizenship. Wow. The reputation as an Irish playwright may no doubt be drawn from his many plays that take place in County Galway.
But isn't that all the UK anyway? I mean...
Girl, you best be
I don't mean to simplify
about...
it. I mean, but they are
all that
all
stuff
in the
between
UK.
Ireland and England. That's all straightened out, right?
No, that's what I'm No, I'm just saying, like, it's the UK, unless you're in Northern Ireland.
Right, but I think you get
which is
no,
its own country, yeah.
No, I mean, yes, but Ireland's still its own country.
Right. Okay. And I think there's some patriotism to being like,
of course.
We're
yes.
Not.
Right. Listen, my mom's last name is McCarthy and our house is covered in four leaf clovers and green. So like, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm Irish, but I know little about my,
my family
heritage
knows nothing.
Or,
they just know their last name that starts with Mick. That's
what
it.
What county are you from?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Scott County.
But McDonagh is also known as one of the innovators of, quote, in-your-face theater, which was the new wave of theater that emerged in the 1990s. It was experimental and extreme, designed to confront, offend, and shock sensibilities. All McDonagh staples.
Yeah.
The Beauty Queen of Lenin is considered an archetype of the genre, which also includes Sarah Kane's Blasted and Anthony Nielsen's Penetrator, which I've never seen or read, but here is pretty fucking crazy. Maybe
yeah, I've heard
next
it's good.
Season.
Yeah. What a title.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's an interesting tidbit. In 1997, he was the only playwright to have four plays running simultaneously on professional London stages.
Fucking A.
Other than Shakespeare, who
Damn.
Had five going.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he
Which, according to McDonagh, like, he doesn't even think Shakespeare's one person.
Yeah, right?
And part of that is the idea that I think a lot of people would prescribe to, which is the idea of like the company built the shows together and Shakespeare was the guider of the story, therefore put his name on it. But I think he even takes it a step further as, like, the collective named themselves William Shakespeare.
Right,
like,
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
know
yeah,
about
yeah.
all that. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, quite all right. Yeah, he likes being provocative. Both the Royal Court and the Royal National Theatre refused to stage his controversial Tony Award-winning play, The Lieutenant of Inishmore.
Good play.
Because of its flagrant satire of the Irish Republican Army and their widespread terrorist attacks, the two theatres feared that they would be targeted by IRA members. It was the Royal Shakespeare Company, RSC, in 2006 that finally staged the play.
Fuck yeah.
Since 2017, McDonagh has been in a relationship with actress and writer Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Meow.
He is a vegetarian.
What a weird couple, but also so
it's just
correct.
A genius couple, right?
Yeah, yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
It's
yes.
really cool. Okay.
It's like it's sort of like the UK version of Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach.
Noah Baumbach. Yeah, yeah, sure. I can see that. Except just like a little more raunchy.
A little darker.
A little darker. Yeah.
McDonagh currently resides in East London. In his own words, McDonagh's writing, quote, walks that line between comedy and cruelty, and his work span the gamut of what great theater and film can be, delightful, dramatic, and dangerous.
Mm.
And so endeth Scottpedia.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Did you talk about his awards?
No, I didn't get into all that because there's so many. There's so many.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I thought we would be talking throughout.
He's got an Academy Award, which we'll get. Yeah, next week when I do my step through of the actual chronology of his shit, I'll talk what won awards and things because he's got BAFTAs, he's got Golden Globes, he's got Olivier's, he's got Tony's. He's doing the whole bit.
And an Oscar.
And an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's kind of handsome.
He's a babe.
Yeah, right? He's like kind of dashing. Yeah.
Dial of Destiny was kind of good.
I liked it. I had a good time.
As long as we all agree.
Yeah.
I think if it had come out, my Letterboxd review is if it had come out 20 years ago, it would have been everybody's favorite in the franchise.
Dial of Destiny written by Martin McDonagh, by the way.
No, but his longtime partner is in it, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. That's why I brought it up. But because she's also attractive.
If they would have done this movie,
they're both weird looking and attractive at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. She's sexy.
But Dial of Destiny.
Fuck.
Good. Dial of Destiny. Good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, good take on that. I agree. If it would have been like 2 years after Crystal Skull or. Instead of Crystal Skull.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We'd all be like, that's the best one besides Raiders, right? Like, that would be the thing. But because we've all sort of, Force Awakens and Marvel has sort of ruined us. I think people were like, boo, nostalgia. And I was like, come on.
Well, and Jim Caviezel's film beat it out one weekend.
Yeah.
Sound of Freedom?
Sound of Freedom.
That's being, what's it, what's it called? Not astroturfing, but they buy out audiences. So oh, yeah. It looks like isn't the numbers that are high.
Like what most bestsellers do with books. Like whatever company publishes them buys a shit ton of copies the first weekend it comes out, and then it's on the New York Times bestseller list.
Or yeah, or like maybe organizations, like politicians, like a lot of like the Heritage Foundation will go sure. and buy books.
Fuck
right.
The Heritage
yeah, but
Foundation.
When it's a QAnon oh, thing, it feels more nefarious for some reason. Anyway,
oh, it is, yeah, absolutely.
No, absolutely, absolutely, fucking lutely.
Because it is nefarious.
Yes,
it is,
yes.
Especially with movies. It's like, you don't need to do that.
Jesus yeah. in a QAnon movie. Yes.
Yeah. Aw. You think Jesus would come back and do a movie?
Yes. Well, I think he was totally a fame whore.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you have to
we could have
to
him
a
do the next live version of Jesus Christ Superstar should just star Jesus.
Yeah. What if Ted Neely is the second coming of Jesus?
I think he might be. What if John Legend is?
I'd follow that savior.
Honestly, same.
Oh, CJ.
I might have to come out of my atheism.
Oh, I could do it. I could get on that. Okay, what are we talking about today? CJ, your pick.
Yes. I just picked it because it was a title I'd seen all over the place. And I was like, well, let's do it. Because I think we all said Pillow Man at the same time.
We're all like, Pillow Man, my choice is Pillow Man.
And Pillow
yeah,
Man.
We're going to do Pillow Man.
But this was just Fate. A title I'd seen several places. I was like, well, let's do it then. Yeah. That's why I picked it.
It's the start of his Lenon trilogy. Apparently that is the Irish way of saying it. Lenon.
Lenon.
Good.
I had to look up a bunch of videos. Of
I meant to look it up
it
and I
right. figured it out because I kept hearing it different ways. And then I found this video from the original production in the 90s. It's this guy like interviewing the woman playing
at the Galway
Madge.
Theater.
Correct.
Yeah.
And no, but this is after. This is once they've taken it to Broadway.
Oh.
And this very American man is asking questions about it, and he sort of gets corrected by her, but without her saying anything. She just says it correctly after he says it incorrectly.
Sure, right. sure.
And I was like, okay, got it. Now I know.
Yeah. You're a Lenon. Local, say it.
Now we know. Yeah.
Lenon.
But I had not read this. This was a fun first.
Ooh, yeah.
Agreed.
This was really fun.
Yeah.
And did he have a play before this?
I think he'd written before, but this was the big one, I think, that was first produced.
Yeah, yeah. On a wide scale, yeah.
But yeah, it was, I got sucked in. I was like,
I loved it.
I kind of glanced at it and then like, oh, let me check out what's going on. And then I'll read it later, which happens sometimes. And then just got pulled in. It was like,
sure.
Oh, I'm going to sit down and keep reading this. Yeah.
I'm going to sit down a spell.
Well, the play premiered in 1996 in Galway, Ireland, put on by the Druid Theatre Company.
Oh, that's so sexy.
Good name.
Yeah, sexy as fuck.
Oh, I love it. I'd love to know what it's about.
Would you?
Kind of.
Yeah. So, okay. So Jay.
Yes.
Help me out.
Yeah.
CJ's Breakdown.
Maureen, a 40-something spinster, continues to begrudgingly take care of her 70-year-old mother, Mag, in a rural Irish town. An ages-old flirtation, Peyto, is back in town and is excited to see Maureen and, later in their evening reunion, claim her V-card, much to Mag's horror. Small-town politics, tropes, small-minded jokes, and even a sweet little romance ensue to end in a way that made me, CJ, gasp and holler. A small-town story that I'd wager a lot of sleepy places have.
Wow, yeah, true.
Yeah.
Yep.
A tragicomedy.
Yes.
I'm now that I've read through Pillow Man 2 and I know Banshees, I think that's just his bag.
It is.
Like I know to sit down and expect when I read his stuff. I knew Pillow Man was going to be like creepy in some way because it's just a creepy ass motherfucking title.
Yeah.
But this one I had no idea and I was getting sucked in by I was a little weirded out by the mother-daughter relationship about like, what's going on there? Like what happened? Which what I love about his writing in this is he leaves it so open. So you can like come up with your own ideas about what is going on between them. Like I was cheering for Maureen for the most part the whole way through. And then, he just pulled the rug out.
I don't know that I was. That's tough. Yeah. Cause I did have that bit of like, Maureen is more physical in all ways. She throws the food out. She does, you know, she has a more physical presence towards Mag than, and Mag is more mental abuse, yeah. But they're like both abusing each other in their own way. And there's a lot more to say about all of that relationship and, yeah. and the show in general.
Sure.
But I think Martin McDonagh, to compare him to another white writer who likes to, male writer who likes to push the envelope, yes. Besides mm-hmm. the fact that obviously he's distinctly Irish and Sam Shepard is distinctly American.
Sure.
Forget that for a second. In terms of writing style, there's a lot of similarities here, but I would argue McDonagh is wittier.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
Shepard's a little more raw.
A little more raw, yeah. And I think McDonagh is also is slightly more clever in the way that he structures his dialogue.
Yeah, even though Shepard uses his as a blunt instrument.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what excited me most reading this, especially this is his first play as I'm reading. I'm sure he had written before this, but this is his first legitimate outing. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yeah.
And like CJ said something that triggered me. The space he leaves for interpretation, for going down paths, the breadcrumbs he sprinkles as you're going, the traps he sets, and what I mean by that is the traps he sets for actors. Like Maureen could really be played, and I imagine there's a lot of bad Maureen performances out there, because you could go and play her as crazy, quote unquote. You could play Mag as, you know,
crazy
but also just malevolent, just generally sort of evil, you know, and the two dudes have their own vibes, and I think are far more metaphorical than the other two. They're less fleshed out, I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really struck me, like, how he strings you along, and you're there's the first moment I realized that Maureen might have had something to do with Mag's hand.
Yes.
I can't remember exactly how it's unveiled, but I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, did she do that? Like, it's like the stage direction is like, there's a pause, there's a look, and then they both go back to their business, and I'm like, and he raises tension like a motherfucker. The whole scene with Ray and the letter, where you're just like, bro, just wait, bro.
Yes.
Bro, wait. And he's just built that up so much because you're hoping for a good thing, and then it goes off the rails.
Yeah. There's a shit ton of stage direction in this play.
A lot. And I'm interested to see how that evolves.
Agreed. Yeah, right. If we're looking at the evolutions of playwrights, I'm excited to see how that changes, because I don't remember Pillow Man having much. I remember feeling sparse.
It's more about the story. Well, there's a lot of storytelling in Pillow Man, too, where they just stop and you listen to a short story for four pages.
And it also is more of an invite to a director to be like, I don't know, what do you want to do with this? Tell this story. Whereas this one does feel more specific. And some of it feels like this is just what they found in the room for the first production and they put it in the script. It doesn't always feel like him being like, you must do it.
Could have been the stage
this.
Manager that put all that shit in there.
Correct. Because they're not written like August Wilson and these like poetic, prose. They're pretty exact and specific. And I do, however, think because there's so much important action that has to happen without dialogue, that it doesn't feel like, we've talked about other writers who it feels like they're telling me how to direct or act play. It didn't feel that way for me.
No.
It felt like, no, this is necessary storytelling.
Right.
This has to happen here. Figure out how to do it. You put your spin on it. But
It kind of almost reminded me of like Killer Joe is like really heavy on stage direction.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You remember that? Like the Tracy Letts play. It just has like a lot of like, and then she very specifically gets on her knees and he puts the chicken wing in her mouth. Then he does this exact thing to her and you're like, oh Jesus.
I still remember having read Killer Joe instead of seeing it first. I didn't know that the body was in the garbage bag on stage until the stage direction at the end of Act 2.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, fuck.
That is an important stage direction.
It is. It's great, though. Yeah. It's great. But yeah, so I'll be interested to see, you know, where he ends up in these next two plays, because we're basically skipping a decade each time, which I love. Yeah. Or like crossing a decade with each play that we're covering.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I had to burp.
Yeah, no, it's sexy.
Oh. All right.
Okay, so we brought this up earlier, but I think CJ, you maybe can definitely speak to this better than Scott and I can. But the interesting nature of a daughter and her mother, mm-hmm. and what that entails in general. And
you want to talk to me about mommy issues?
Well, I just mean, I think it's a very, it transcends America. It transcends race. It transcends time, like family issues, right?
Yes. It's
like when I have gone to other countries and taught Shakespeare, and you're telling the story of Hamlet, and a kid raises their hand and they're like, I have an uncle like that. You're like, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's that thing. I think it's very universal. And so automatically you're drawn in. You're like, okay, I know these relationships. But there's that side of it of caring for her for 20 years and that dynamic of having to or deciding to take care of someone who used to take care of you,
right.
especially in a mother-daughter relationship, is interesting and odd. It's very odd.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a lot of potential drama and comedy, and that's what this play sort of is. But I want to hear from you, CJ, like, what did this affect you in any way? Were you like, yes, correct?
Or, yes, well,
he's a man writing this, so I wonder.
I will say that on our last episode, both of these women's roles are going to be on my dream roles list, first of all.
Sorry to cut you off, because I want to say this about that. He doesn't have a lot of female roles.
Yeah.
Like, big, juicy ones, anyway.
Yeah.
He has Frances McDormand in three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri, but he doesn't have three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. But besides that, if you read his other plays, like, it's so male-centric.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really surprised when I started this. I was like, oh, shit. These are juicy
I was too.
Roles.
I was surprised, too.
In either role.
Thank you.
Maureen,
I mean,
now, Mag in 30, 40 years.
The only thing that I was immediately looking for was a year on this. Like, when is it supposed to be produced? Because I gotta say, 96. The 40... I know, but I mean, like, when is the play supposed to be?
Yeah.
Because 96, the idea...
Like,
Yeah, I mean, I the idea of a 40-year-old virgin to me, unless it's a religion thing, seems a little. But at the same time, like, I didn't. I guess now that I've done one movie and two of his plays, I don't think he's going for full on 100% realism all the time.
Sure,
so
true.
So you can have like a character like that. I mean, the first thing I thought of, honestly, was the scene. I don't know if y'all have seen Mad Men, but it's the scene where you meet. His first wife, the one that looks like Princess Grace, her dad. And her dad has Alzheimer's in the 60s. And nobody knows what it is yet. So he's walking around the house forgetting stuff and being belligerent. Right. And people are yelling at him for it because they think he's being difficult.
Right.
So that's like the first thing I thought of. I was like, is this some old-timey thing where mom is difficult, but she has issues, and we're not being sympathetic to that because we don't know any better?
Well,
but
Maureen then definitely treats her that way, right?
Right, right. Yeah. But then the other thing, but then as I got into it, I was like, no. I now want to know what this woman did to her daughter. And you see what she's continuing to do to her.
Right.
So you can... Pouring hot oil on anyone's hand is never the answer. But it also makes an interesting dynamic, too, of, like, why that woman stays there. Like,
right.
She really must have pissed off everyone else in her life and must be poor enough that she can't find herself.
Right.
Because even though her daughter is awful and violent to her, she depends on her and needs her, and it makes a really interesting dynamic, because I'm sure there's, because the other side of it is the resentment from Maureen of, like, I have two sisters that won't help out with you, and I'm stuck here because of you, and now you're finding out I don't know that boys have crushes on me because of you, you know what I mean, like, I just
also
loved all of it.
I think the other thing too is place and location seems to be very, very important to him, through the titles of the plays and movies and all that.
And
Ireland.
After 700 years of generational oppression. Trauma.
Right, exactly. But also just the isolation of a small village, a small town that where they're constantly talking about trying to get out, where they have to, some of them have to get out in order just to make a living. They have to go to London, they have to go to England. And and so how that sort of plays on the characters and is as big a thing as any of the things that the characters do to each other.
Right.
It's sort of the place and time. And you all, it's also, you get the sense that it's one of those places that whatever year it is, it's 10 years behind.
Sure.
And,
but also the interestingness, and you could perceive it as kind of backwardness of like, how many families do you know that I know that have an elderly parent that needs help? And no, of course, they're moving in with us.
Right.
And we're going to take care of them.
That's
right.
Especially in a society that has so much shared trauma and bullshit that they're going on with. But then obviously, excuse me, the slight backwardness of just being 110% resentful of it the entire fucking time.
Oh, right.
And everybody's miserable.
Right.
Everybody's miserable.
And there's that cyclical nature of their relationship, obviously. The mother who has traumatized the daughter, who then now is taking care of the mother and is sort of re-traumatizing the mother. But the mother has never dealt with the collective trauma of her mother. And her mother never dealt with the trauma of her mother. And her mother never dealt with the 700 years of oppression that we just
talked about.
Everyone needs therapy. Everyone needs therapy, right? And I think generational trauma is a big thing. I talk about a lot in my relationships about, you know... especially where there's that thing of like the buck has to stop somewhere, and it's unfortunate that it has to be us now being the where the buck stops. But I think that's the purpose of our time right now. These generations, these past few generations, our whole thing is like, we're able to see it now, so let's get into therapy.
Yeah.
Let's change who we are, you know, a little bit. And this becomes a microcosm in some ways for that entire trauma, that entire 700 years of whatever. And we're watching these two isolated people have to deal with that collective trauma on their own. And obviously comedy comes from that, but then it also leads us to the darker side of the play.
And sometimes the buck stops with matricide.
And sometimes that's the only way to stop it. And I don't think that's what the play's arguing, but in some ways, like, that's what it feels like, right? Is like, maybe we just fucking kill each other and then it's over.
And it goes back to CJ's initial point about that there's so much room for interpretation and how to play this. Like, it seemingly comes out of nowhere, especially the pouring of the oil. Like, but it doesn't. Like, feel like you quickly get where it's coming from real fast, and then that turn is just so fucking dark, and you're just like, what? And then when you realize that it's all been in her head, or that she's imagined stuff, or that she's hallucinated. You know, and the damage that she's been carrying and the sadness that she's been carrying. I think that that's the most Irish thing about it, is that it's so much, it's so funny. The dialogue quips like lightning fast.
But it's sorrowful. It's hilarious. Underneath so it, sad.
Sorrowful. Good word.
It's just, you don't like, laugh, you're going to cry. Just,
yeah, exactly. Like they've, you know,
which is
you're
what Banshees is to a T. Also,
oh, yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see elements of those characters in all those, you know, Banshees characters, especially the sister in that.
I got a little bit of a hint of Nottage's intimate apparel when he wrote that letter to her from I remember reading through the scene where what's like scene 4 or 5 where she's gone to see Pato at his welcome home party. They've spent the night together. He's taken her virginity. They're having a great time. And I had this worry of like, oh, is he going to like disappear the next morning? And she's going to have to deal with that, which is another thing I can talk about. But
he doesn't take her virginity.
Yeah, he does. That's the impression I got.
The letter, he basically reveals that he wasn't able to perform, and he dismisses it as the drink that he was drunk.
Oh, well, maybe I need to reread it.
They just lay together. Yeah.
Well, anyway, so I guess the thing that I was going for was the scene then where it's the next morning and she's fighting with her mother in front of him. And I was just thinking like, oh, fuck, if you really like this guy, he doesn't need to be here for this right now. Oh, no, danger, danger, danger. And then he felt uncomfortable and left. And the sweetness of that letter of like,
the forgiveness.
I don't care if you had to, if you had to be in a home to help you out when you were going through a thing. I don't care about your weird relationship with your mom. Like, I think you're beautiful. Like, it was such a sweet letter. And I was like, oh my God, please let this work out for this woman.
Right. Well, but then go ahead. Bez.
No, but mine's a pivot sort of.
But I was going to say that scene, the morning after scene is just so like, that's another point where you just sort of see her darkness, the anger that she's this is all performative, like she's doing it and she wants her to bug her mother by doing this, and it's just so like you're like, oh do I like her, do I, what, I don't know what to think of her,
right?
Maureen, that is
right. And I think it'd be easy to read or watch or even direct this play in a way that makes us walk away saying, oh, she's just crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the best version of this show is where you really go with the empathy and you try to empathize with both of them in some ways, but especially with Maureen. I think you have to, or it hurts real bad. But I like CJ obviously read it more on Maureen's side, right, Siege?
No, I knew there was something weird and fucking dark going on between her and her mother. And I didn't think she was 100% innocent by any means. But I just wanted it. I wanted it to work out for her in a way that she could leave. There could be space and she could move on and have a life and be away. And her mom could be away from each other and stop being shitty to one another. And so, I knew she was fucked up, but, like, I still was rooting for her a little
bit. That's the magic trick of the play, right?
Yeah.
Is, like, you care, and also you don't really know. You're sort of, like, because they both tell separate stories to Pato or Peto or whatever, however you say his name, and he only believes Maureen, but we don't really know who to believe. And I think there's a way to direct it where that magic trick really, really plays, where we have no idea until we know. But even when she's doing it, like actually threatening her with it, we still have to question, like, okay, but is she threatening because this is something that's been talked about, or did she do this before? Right? There's still that question, which is so interesting. But then, you know, I think playing it with the empathy, directing it towards the empathy, makes it so that when she's standing at the train station alone in her little black dress and it doesn't feel like we've just watched a psychopath for the past 2 hours. Like, we still care about her and where she ends up. She's a true human.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's been damaged, and that's her actions are, you know, just like you said, the cycle of abuse, whether, you know, it's overt or, you know, subconscious, you know. It's,
yeah, because who knows what happened between her and her mom when her mom was younger and in much better health. I mean, maybe there was physical abuse on that side. Like, I don't know. Or maybe Maureen is a stone-cold psychopath. You don't fucking know.
Right. Well, and you just brought up something really interesting, Siege, because they're a mom and daughter, and they're living in this very small, crowded home where there used to be other people. Used to be, you know, so it's probably more crowded then, but there was, like, love, and now that's kind of, like, all dissipated, right? But Mag, and I'm getting to your point, CJ, Mag only eats beige food. They sort of talk about this, like, the porridge and nothing.
The Compline.
The Compline.
Which is, like, carnation instant breakfast. My mom shoved that down my throat for 10 fucking years.
So she's basically living a life getting no true sustenance or joy out of any, like, pleasure out of anything. Right.
But she'll complain if it's not perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And nothing's giving her life or energy or drive and in general. And I think when you know someone like a parent in their prime or like a teacher, like early on in their prime, and then you see them in an unwell state or in a frail state.
Yeah.
It can be really difficult and jarring, and it's probably hard to admit sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what leads to her, when she's watching her mother being frail and she doesn't really believe her, mm-hmm. when in reality her mom is like pretty sick and not doing well, but Maureen sort of talks like if you really wanted to be better, you could be better.
Yeah.
Which is sort of how a lot of parents talk to their children.
Yeah.
Right? Is like, okay, find your smile. You're fine. You're yeah. okay. Mm-hmm. You're not hurt.
Crocodile tears.
Right. And that's driven by the fear of being alone in some ways. She doesn't want her mom to die. She doesn't want to admit that her mom could possibly die. So loneliness, Scott, you brought up. And I think loneliness is sort of the key thematic, you know, word for this entire play.
Mm-hmm.
Is just, it's sort of about loneliness and it about
isolation, I think, too.
And isolation and
trying to figure a way out. Like, that's, you know.
Right, right. Clawing your
way
out.
What do we think? This is a digression. What do we think about Ray? What's Ray in this play? Like, what point? There was part of me that's like, oh, he sort of represents chaos and randomness, but he also represents the town. He's sort of the immediate outside of this house reporting in what's going on. And you can feel that he's got this energy and he's impatient. But what does he represent?
I just saw him as a dipshit townie the whole time that obviously has lived under the shadow of his brother, who went out and quote unquote made something of himself, who got out, and he's stuck in this town, and now he's delivering letters to these women that he doesn't want to be spending his fucking time with. This is so annoying. Like, that I just saw him as like funny townie dude, like that, you know, the worst guy that you could pick to do something important for you type of thing.
Right, right. Bales?
Lone Star. Remember that play we talked about last week?
Yeah.
He's the epitome of that, right? It's like, and not, it doesn't go into him being like a real delusional townie or anything like that. It feels that way. You're correct, CJ. But it's not, they don't get into it like they do in Lone Star. But we read the James McClure script Lone Star for last week. And I've been thinking a lot about it because it is kind of about the people who are sort of vacant of the reality of the, even though it exists within them, they sort of pretend it doesn't, the reality of like their collective trauma or their past trauma or their whatever, and the ability to sort of delude yourself and
feeling like knowing deep down that he's never accomplished anything and all he has to do is make that next step, but he's never gonna, because deep down he's fucking terrified too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Lone not Star. Just dipshit towny funny dude. I mean, there's there's some darkness going on in there.
For
but
sure.
I went to high school with a lot of those guys that are still drunken townies where I'm from, in a tiny town where nothing ever happens.
And
but everybody knows them and they complain loudly about things.
And like McNunnick does a good job of characters like that. Like, there's a character like that very specifically in Three Billboards. There's definitely a character like that in Banshees, the Barry Keoghan.
I love that actor so much.
It's different because you love the Barry Keoghan.
He's very sweet.
But it's these tertiary characters that may not hold a thematic weight to the play, but they definitely hold an emotional.
He's Balthazar. He doesn't deliver the letter. Like, I mean, he's the plot device, too, in some ways.
Right, yeah. Right. I agree. Okay. Is there anything else you want to say about this play?
Oh, I enjoyed the fuck out of it.
It's really fucking good.
Yeah.
I think there's something to say about the language that's interesting. We talked. I compared it.
Needed a glossary in the back. I kept looking things up.
But the rhythms of the language and the mild repetition that he plays with kept giving me bald soprano vibes in moments. Just like being in a living room and like that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
To me, it was the George Bernard Shaw of it all. I wrote down, is he writing in dialect? And he is a little bit.
He's probably just writing how he would say it, you know, more than anything. Yeah,
but it's very specifically Irish, in my opinion. Like,
Have you ever read Trainspotting?
Mm-mm.
Oh yeah,
it's written the way you would say it, and it's difficult to read.
Yes,
to say the least. But it's good, and it's a lot of slang too. But it's solid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a great time. I'm glad we read this.
Yeah, I was moved by it. I was uneasy. It was I was so into it, and I read it so fast. I'm like, oh man.
I'm really glad I read it blind. Really glad.
I would love to direct it. Like,
yeah. It was nominated for the BBC Award for Play of the Year in 1996. It won the 98 Drama Desk when it was on Broadway for Outstanding Play, and the Drama League Award for Best Play the same year, 98.
Nice.
Pretty cool.
It got nominated for some Tonys, right?
Yes. No, I don't think it did, actually.
Okay.
I think it had Tony-winning performers in the Broadway
gotcha. Mm.
show, but I don't think it got any Tony noms.
It rules.
It rules. It rules. Okay, so what else? I forgot what else we do on this podcast. We talked about the play. Next week we'll do chronology.
Yeah.
Next week we'll do chronology. Then the third week we'll rank.
Yeah. Third week we'll rank.
And do dream rolls.
Cool. Well, I loved this. I think it's a great start to the discussion of McDonagh. I think he's...
It's a pleasant surprise for me.
Yeah, and I think he has a lot more to show us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially with Banshees being as successful as it was. And Three Billboards was too, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And he's directing more, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a good director. His quote is like, I'm the laziest film director of all time. I just like get the footage and move on. But he's got an eye. It looks really good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
As well. But yeah.
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 He clearly knows how to create delicious things for actors and directors. So maybe that makes him a good film director.
Mm-hmm.
He's a natch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the simplicity of his directing feels a bit theatrical. It feels a bit like watching a play sometimes, which I think a lot of people said about Banshees. They were like, it felt like a play. And I was like, it was a play. And then he made another movie.
LA Spotlight.
What you got?
I'm seeing some stuff this weekend, but I'm going to go see In the Heights at the Morgan Wixen in Santa Monica.
It'll be closed by the time this episode comes
out.
Yes, we are.
I'm seeing some stuff this weekend, but I don't have anything coming up at the moment until like November.
Yeah,
but
my Midsummer Night's Dream that only has five rehearsals and directed by the kids themselves.
That's wonderful.
Goes up on Friday and then Saturday, but this episode won't be out by then, so
yeah,
doesn't matter.
Totally.
Sky, you got anything?
No, not at the moment, but I have some announcements coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go
Sorry,
see theater.
I shouted that out.
Yeah. Go see theater.
Well,
okay.
See some fun movies. There's some fun shit out
there
right now.
A lot of good movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of good movies. Barbenheimer.
Barbenheimer.
I'm seeing Barbenheimer tomorrow. Can't wait.
Go support the Barbenheimer.
Yeah.
I haven't seen either yet. I'm seeing Barbie tonight and Oppenheimer this weekend because I wanted to make sure I saw the IMAX 70 mil.
Yeah, of course, for Oppenheimer. Of course. Yeah.
Of course, I'm sitting third row. I might hate myself. We'll see.
Oh.
Okay. Thank you for joining us for part one of three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri. Join us next week for part two. We'll do the chronology, and we are covering The Pillow Man.
Pillow Man.
That's all I got.
Y'all have questions or comments? Please reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram.
Instagram.
Scott.
Thank you, DJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Here's a truth, and you're going to have to deal with it. Our theme song is better than your fucking theme song.
Fucking
bitch.
He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
Yes.
Correct.
We need to come up with a fun voice for Martin McDonagh.
Martin McDonagh. He just sounds like this. Like a little boy.
It sounds like
little
Pinter.
Irish boy.
I don't hate it.
We'll work on it. We'll get back. We'll follow up next week.
Okay.
Bailey.
Subscribe, rate, review. Really does help.
Wow, that's creepy.
That's
wow,
creepy,
CJ.
We
creepy.
Love you. We'll see you next week.
Love ya.
Bye.
I want to be a producer.
No, you don't.
I don't know the words. I was in it for 2 months and I don't know the words. I wanna be a producer. La da 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 da.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
Later, everybody.
The theater, the theater.
Theater.